Hello, we're back. We're back from being kicked out of Zoom. Okay, are we ready with les questions?
Yes, yes.
Oh, actually, I have one. Shall I start with this one?
Go for it.
What's the difference between power and strength? Should we train differently for these? In my head, I tend to think of power as a dynamic or explosive type of strength, but not sure if that's actually supported by the evidence.
When it comes to things like rep ranges, the normal sort of strength rep ranges are generally 3 to 5 reps. And in rep and powers, normally 6 to 8. With power stuff, I would probably look to have somebody maybe going at a quicker tempo, not on like a downwards phase, like the eccentric phase, but on much more explosive on the sort of concentric phase of the movement. So like a squat, you're firing out the bottom of the hole as quick as you can. You would also
firing out the bottom of that hole.
And there's the first euphemism of the day. And it's only Tuesday. Is it Tuesday or Monday?
It's Monday.
I don't even know what day it is. Monday even. Then you would, with power stuff, you'd also potentially bring in things like plyometric work. There is a different way to train towards power than there is towards strength.
Yeah. And an easy way to look at it is the definition of strength and power. So the definition of strength is the absolute amount of force you can apply to something, and you'll be strongest in a like an isometric position. And then the definition of power is strength times speed. So you need the strength and the speed. So you want to apply force, but very quickly. So that would be something like sprinting and things like that. That's like a huge power output there. So yes, they are different, and you basically had that right, that power is more dynamic and explosive. Yep. Okay, question 2. I know the main focus of training is resistance. I do stuff with bands and dumbbells a lot, but also HIIT sessions on the Fit app too. As you know, I love it. These involve lots of lunges, jumps, jump squats, press-ups, blah, blah, blah. It's not just straight cardio like a jog as such. Does this count towards the goal of resistance too? For some reason, I feel bad if I do a HIIT session as I know you prefer resistance, but do these bodyweight type workouts count? Yes, they count. That is resistance training. So your bodyweight is resistance. Obviously, it's lower relative resistance probably than when you do weight training. But yeah, it absolutely counts. So one way to think about it is exercise is on a spectrum. So if you look at like strength training, like real strength training, like 5x5 or something at one end of the spectrum, and then like running marathons at the other end of the spectrum, everything else comes somewhere in between. So if you're looking at like body weight style circuit HIIT training, maybe somewhere in the middle. Resistance training that I've programmed is maybe closer towards the strength training side, and when you do your cardio, it's closer towards the marathon runner side. It's not as simple as like, this is HIIT training, thus it's cardio, this is this, thus it's strength training or it's resistance training. Everything's on a spectrum, so I wouldn't stress out too much. And actually, that's going to keep you mega fit. I think it's brilliant having in some circuits and body weight type stuff, because I know that you're also doing your resistance training as well. That is great.
Yep.
Right, Andy, shoot me a question this time.
After a training session, I always crave sugar. I can have a giant bowl of carbs, but this doesn't do anything. Any suggestion on why this is? I could eat everything in sight. Genuinely, after training, you've burnt off calories, which obviously burn off energy. So your body's trying to replace that energy by you eating. A lot of people probably their first thought's going to be for something sweet, but it just depends on the person, I think, more than anything else. I don't have a humongous sweet tooth, so I would actually probably be more inclined to go for something savory, but I think that's personal preference with that kind of stuff, especially if you've had a bit of a monster session, like legs this morning. I trained legs this morning, and I generally don't get hungry after training, but this morning I was like absolutely ravenous. But yeah, I think it's just natural. It's normal.
Yeah. Do you know what's quite interesting? There's a lot of research behind the hunger response to exercise, and a couple of things cause variations in this. So one, like, people vary. Some people, like Andy's saying, doesn't really get hungry after exercise. Other people do. Some people get really hungry after resistance training. Other people don't get any hunger at all after resistance training. Some people feel really hungry after an endurance session. So it is all quite individual and variable. A couple of things I would say is that if you say, oh, I could eat a massive bowl of carbs and I still feel hungry, or I sit like it doesn't even touch the size, and I still have these cravings. Sometimes I think, and I'm just thinking like the week before my period when I crave everything, I don't bother having any of it because it doesn't, like, it never makes the craving go away. If you're someone, and this is completely individual as well, so I'm not saying do as I do, I'm just giving you an example. But if you're someone who is like, oh, you know what, the week before my period, I really crave some chocolate, so I add some chocolate in, and that makes me feel so much better, and I can stick to my diet. Excellent, brilliant, that's what you should be doing. It's obviously working for you. That does not happen to me. If I have some chocolate, I'm still like, I still want chocolate. Like, it doesn't help, so I don't bother doing it. So sometimes I think you just need to be like, well, this will pass, and yep, not react to it. Because if having a massive bowl of whatever carbs, I imagine, doesn't help anyway, then what's the point? And you're not, like, this would be different if you were like an elite level endurance athlete who needs to restore their glycogen. You're not.
Yeah.
Like, your goal is body composition. If it doesn't meet your, like, if it doesn't fit with your goals to eat this massive bowl of carbs and after it you still want more, then maybe you should just ignore that and prove to yourself that you are stronger than your cravings and you don't need to listen to them all the time. And also, because a lot of people are like, well, you should always listen to your body. Not always. Like, not always, especially if maybe your body is trying to defend like the set point that it's at, which for you, if your goal is to lose body fat, is a higher body fat than you want. Now, leaving yourself a little bit hungry or not always listening to your hunger signals is probably going to be a good thing for you to lose body fat.
Yeah.
And then the final thing I would say on that is that just from the way you've written it, and this again is like jumping to conclusions, but it sounds like you're almost talking yourself into it. Like, I am always hungry after this. I always need this. Like, that can quite quickly become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah. I have that psychological break from it and just say, nope, I don't need it. I don't need it.
Try it and see how you feel. Try it for a week and don't react to that and see how you feel. And if you're like, no, like, I feel like I've got no energy and whatever, then fine, then bring it back in. But do it for a week, see how you feel, get back to us. Okay, this one says, not sure if it's just me getting overexcited, but the buzz in the Facebook group this week and last has been incredible. I love it. That wasn't a question, but just a lovely comment I thought I would share. This is a question. It says, so, with many O's, in line with my sleep non-negotiable, I would be interested to hear what the physiological factors behind insufficient sleep, more specifically impact on muscle building, are. I know that with reduced sleep comes reduced training intensity / effort. If everything else is on point, e.g. protein intake, calories, training volume, rest days, how much of an impact can reduced sleep actually have on muscle building?
The question kind of answered itself there. If you are sleeping, if you're not sleeping well, but you're still managing to keep your intensity levels up, that's still your training stimulus is still there. So what you would probably see is you might think that your training intensity is okay, but actually you're probably working at 70% if you potentially have a crap night's sleep, which means that you're not going to get the same response to for the muscle fibers to be damaged to be rebuilt. Even if your nutrition and stuff's on point, you might not be pushing yourself in the gym. It might be something you don't actually notice that you feel, because you're slightly tired, you might feel that you're pushing yourself hard, but you actually aren't. But that's the kind of, that I would say that that question, you would have to, there would be something there. If you're missing out on sleep, your training's going to be affected at some point. Might not be day one, it might not be day two, could be like a week later if you're having crap night sleeps. Might be a week down the line that your training starts to, your intensity starts to fall.
Yeah, did you ever notice that, that like if you get, I don't know, like say you went on a really great night out and you get like 2 hours sleep and then the next day you're like, I still feel great. Like this, I'm fine. I don't think I need that much sleep. And then like the next day you're like, I can't
Emma,
keep my eyes open.
Who are you kidding? You're the same as me. You don't go out.
No, I didn't go out. I'm talking about, you know, back in the uni days.
Back in, yeah, I'm like that. It's been a long time since I've done that. So I,
to be fair, like when I had a really bad back and wasn't sleeping at all, like now and again, I would get genuinely an hour's sleep and still function the next day absolutely fine. But then after a couple of days, I'd be like dead.
Yeah, I am very good at working on little to no sleep. And I can only put
interestingly, only when I'm ridiculously busy. And I think it's because you're just like, well, don't have time to be tired.
Yeah. Well, it's the same. Like, I remember doing that when I did, when I was working doing the doors. I was working doing the doors and then I was doing PT and stuff. So I was finishing at 3 a.m. I was up at 6 to go to clients, work all day, go home for a 2 hour power nap. And you'd be, you know, I could manage that
a
for
2 hour like, power nap. Power naps are meant to be like 20 minutes.
No. This is the myth. This is the myth that everybody says. A nap can last from 20 minutes to 6 hours. That's what I tell myself.
But if that's it's six and a half, that's asleep.
Six hours, 1 minute. That's proper. That's
you've gone too far. Okay. So what I would add to that is, you say, so like, I guess you're right, Andy, the question sort of answers itself in that, like, okay, well, you're saying if protein intake, calories, training volume, rest days were all on point, like, would it matter if I wasn't sleeping? Yes, because you simply wouldn't recover. Like, we need sleep to recover, and you just wouldn't. And even if you think that your training volume is high or your training intensity is high, the fact is you would be training harder if you had slept.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. I have a question about sugar. I've always been a bit of a bit of a sugar police. I never let my kids have fizzy drinks or fizzy sweets, and I don't drink them myself because the sugar content and my teeth. I do drink fizzy water. I don't drink any diet sodas anymore either. I would say it's been about 4 years since I gave up all sodas. Although the other day I had a can of, sorry, this, I don't think I need to read all of this, but she had a can of something, but it had 71 calories in, and the sugar content was 15 grams, so the equivalent to almost 4 teaspoons of sugar. What are your thoughts on sugar content in food compared to calories? Hope that makes sense. Would be interested in someone else's view. Okay, well, first of all, unfortunately, any fizzy drink isn't good for your teeth, even if it is sugar-free.
I was also going to say fizzy water's not much better either, I don't think.
It's the fizz.
It's not the sugar.
The sugar as well, but yeah. Even if you take the sugar away, the fizz, so not great. And do you know what? Generally, I would say, like, I never drink full fat. I don't know why we call it full fat Coke when it's full sugar Coke, whatever. I never drink anything like that just because I don't think it's worth the calories. Like, I would rather eat my calories than drink them.
I also think that, like, Pepsi Max actually tastes better than normal Pepsi. I think
not had normal Pepsi for so long that I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Like, I actually had a normal Coke maybe 2 weeks ago when I was out for dinner or out for I think I was out for dinner. And it was like, holy shit, that's sweet. Like, and I know that Coke Zero, yeah, I was like, I totally notice the difference and I don't like that taste. So But yeah, I think we like to demonize sugar because it's very easy to demonize. Do I think that people need to intake less? Probably yes, because sugar's such an easy, so easily accessible. It's, you know, and everybody has chocolate, everybody has, you know, there's sweets kicking around. But is it as bad as everybody makes out? I wouldn't say so if you're taking it in moderation. You know, it's, you know, if you're having a small amount, it's not gonna kill you. But
yeah,
you know,
it's context, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very easy to jump on, and that's the problem with stuff like the sugar tax, and you know, guys like celebrity chefs jumping on about the sugar taxes and stuff like that. It's an easy place to attack, but it's probably the one that I put it this way, if I see a kid walking down a street going to school with an iron brew at 8 a.m. in the morning, I'm like, that's fucking horrendous.
Andy walks up, kicks it out of his hands.
Roundhouse kicks it out of their hands. You wee shite, stop drinking iron brew at 8 o'clock in the morning. But when I have kids, I'm not going to stop them from drinking fizzy juice completely. Maybe I'll keep it to a minimum. And so, you know, that's as I had when I was.
Yeah, it is a hard one, isn't it? Because, I mean, like, I grew up eating iron brew bars, which probably the worst thing you could ever eat, and like stick to your teeth and everything, and like, oh, so bad.
You're washing your teeth.
Oh, you couldn't. There's but literally it's nothing.
So good. It's so good though.
Do you still get them?
Yeah, Wham bars as well. They were brilliant.
Dream. But what I was going to say about that is that if you, and I mean, like, I wouldn't want that for my own kids, right? It's not good for them, obviously. But I do think that there's a line, like, if you over-police it, you can do more harm than good, in that, like, as soon as they do have a little bit of freedom, all they do is, like, run off to the shops and then cram in a load of sweets. Or you give them, like, food fear of certain foods. Like, oh, mum says sugar's bad, so I've always been scared of eating sugar. And, like, you don't want that either. You just want it in moderation and, like, obviously this food freedom and just knowing the benefits of eating a good, nutritious, healthy diet, but also allowing them to eat a little bit of what they want. So do you think that is probably a hard, like, it's a hard thing to teach, but I think that's where we want to be. I do think that people...
Everything's hard to teach. You know, as a kid, you don't want to learn stuff, but, you know, if you can get in from an early age that eating sugar in moderation is fine, just don't go mental with it. The same with anything else, you know, we teach kids that drinking alcohol in moderation, you know, you don't go out and get smashed every night because you can see what comes off the back of it. But, you know, I just think that I think it's very easy to jump on and demonize sugar when there actually isn't the educational, there isn't the education in place to actually, to tell kids why.
Yeah, and I mean, the good example is alcohol, where in other countries where people like have a glass of wine for dinner, there's far less problems with alcohol. And in the UK, we have quite a big like binge drinking problem, which they don't have in other countries. Well, not to the same extent.
France, you're allowed to drink from, what is it, 15? Something like that?
I don't 14, even 15? Think, like, I think maybe the law is something like that. But I think, like, growing up, it's just like, oh, mum and dad having some wine, do you want some?
Yeah, that's it. You know,
and it's not like, you know, excessive drinking. It's just a little bit of wine with your dinner. And that's...
Yeah, you look at kids as they grow up in the UK. You know, how many kids did you know when you were growing up who were like pinching, pouring out half a bottle of vodka out of their mum and dad's cupboard, filling it up with water, and then they were running to the local park to hide in the darkness and drink it? Like, if that doesn't tell you there's something wrong with it, but if you're doing that with sugar, you're doing the same thing. All you're doing is you're over-policing to the point where your kids are going to be eating shit anyway, because there's about 10 hours of a day where they're at school or walking home from school where they have the pound, £2, £3 in their pockets. They're just going to go and do that. So don't, just tell them, just be more, educate them, give them the whys, give them, because kids understand this stuff. Like, I think we forget that kids
are
smart.
What is really hard though, and it's really hard because not even adults can do this, but like doing things that your future self will be thankful for is a really hard concept. And even like psychology's shown that we don't even see our future selves as ourselves. they're like, oh, future Emma can deal with that. Like, if you tell kids now, you know, if you eat too much sugar, you'll have really bad teeth when you're older. It'll be really painful at the dentist, and it's going to cost you a hell of a lot of money to get them fixed. Or, like, worse, your teeth will fall out or whatever. They're kind of like, oh, yeah, but they're fine now. Or you do the complete opposite and they scare the absolute hell out of them, and then they're like, never go near sugar again.
Again, there's not a right way, is there? That's...
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point. I do think that the sugar tax is a good thing in many respects. I do think that it's going to cause companies to reduce the sugar, well, already has, to reduce the sugar in things. Iron Brew being a prime example.
Yeah.
So I think that is a good thing. All right, okay. Do you think we spoke enough about sugar?
Yeah.
Okay, I've got a couple more, and then do you want to go on to your ones?
Yeah.
Okay, so been feeling a little disheartened and deflated that I don't quite feel in control of myself at times. But I have to focus on the positives. I don't think this is a question. Nope, it's not. I don't know why I wrote it down. I think that's all that I need to answer from my one-to-ones. So crack on with commit to six.
Right. I have a goal to complete 3 sets of 10 bodyweight pull-ups. That's a pretty decent goal to start with. I used to use eccentric training to help with this, pull-ups, and then I moved on to drop sets using rows or flat pull-downs. My question is, drop sets or eccentric training, which one is better for recruiting muscle fibers to induce muscle hypertrophy or strength? In brackets, the burn is real with drop sets. Yes, it is. This is a sort of question I would take into two parts. If you're wanting to get better at pull-ups, you get better at pull-ups by doing pull-ups. So doing a drop set using a different piece of kit is going to give you some carryover, but not as much as doing like eccentric. Like, the eccentric phase of a movement is generally where you're building your strength. So that's what I would probably look at doing for your pull-ups. However, for recruiting muscle fibers for hypertrophy, doing your pull-ups then drop setting onto another piece of kit is going to give you more muscle fiber recruitment and the sort of cellular damage that you're going to get for hypertrophy. So I'd probably run that into two different categories on that one.
Yeah, I'm going to go for option C, which is neither. I think that like volume is king here, right? And either of these things. So we know that one of the negatives to doing a lot of eccentric loading is that it's going to affect your volume. It creates more muscle damage, which means that like anyone who's tried to do an eccentric pull-up knows that it's going to be much harder than doing one that's not eccentric, for example.
Yep.
If you're already at the stage that like your goal is 3 sets of 10 pull-ups, I would be looking at trying to just get like increased volume, because eccentrics tend to be quite good if you're trying to get your first like 2 or 3 pull-ups. But once you can do that, you can start trying to add a bit more volume in there. And, you know, if you really wanted to, right at the end, you could do a bit of a drop set, maybe. But I would still rather you took a little bit of a break and did a whole nother set of 5 or 6 or whatever, depending on how many sets you want to look at. But the key here is volume. And when you're looking at drop sets, you might get, like, the theory behind that would be more metabolic or metabolite buildup, which was thought or might still be thought to increase the building of muscle. And then eccentric would be increased damage, again, increased building potential. But what we now know is the most important is volume. So I would say that both of these things, drop sets and eccentric loading, would negatively affect volume. So don't go for either of them and just go for increased volume over time. One thing that I would say is that if you're looking to do that amount of pull-ups, which is insanely impressive, I would start doing weighted pull-ups.
Yep.
So like maybe you do, I don't know, a couple of sets of 5x5 weighted pull-ups and then a drop set where you just take the weight off and do body weight to failure.
Yep. Perfect. Perfect. Next one. How important is it to hit the 100 grams of protein on a rest day? Does your body actually use all the protein if you aren't resistance training, or does it get wasted?
It is very important for various reasons. It will use the protein. 100 grams isn't actually very much. If you were like, is it important to get 200 grams of protein? I'd be like, no. But 100 grams of protein isn't actually that much. We set the bar quite low just so that you can all hit it. And that's like a minimum. Remember that that is a minimum. The protein target is a minimum. The calorie target is a maximum. So yes, still get it in on rest days. Remember that rest days are also recovery days. So you need that protein for recovery as well.
Yeah. Excellent. I'm not going to add anything else to that one. That's pretty awesome. Can I sub some of my step goal for time on my exercise bike at home? Sometimes I end up waiting on someone at work and then they reply, have a quick deadline to work to. So I can't be too far from home. I know it's not exactly equal measurable in the same way as steps, but it would be helpful to have a benchmark so if I know I'm unlikely to get more than 4K steps one day, should I do X minutes on the bike over the day? Question kind of answered there. You can't really compare them, so we can't tell you how many steps you would need to do to equate onto however many kilometers on the bike or however many minutes on the bike. But, you know, if you're getting 4K steps, if you're managing a half an hour on the bike, I would say perfect. You know, I would say that's a pretty good, it's a pretty good mark. You know, a half an hour on a bike is going to be take you, obviously it's going to take you 30 minutes because it's 30 minutes on the bike.
But, well done, Andy. But, well done.
Yes. See what I did there?
Yeah.
But yeah, you can't equate them, but I would say that for sort of 5,000 steps, you know, if you can even that out at half an hour on a bike, you're probably going to be there or thereabouts.
Mm. Yeah, as Andy's saying, so yes and no. Like, yes, you obviously can. So steps are just a marker of energy expenditure. That's why we're using steps, because it gives us an idea of how much energy you're expending over the day, how active you are. Now, if you're doing that on a bike, that also expends energy. So yes, you can swap them. But what is very hard, and what Andy's just alluded to, is that we don't know what resistance you're on. We don't know how fast you're pedaling. We don't know all these factors. Like, that's why steps are quite easy, because it's not as simple as just to be like, sit for 30 minutes on a bike. Okay, you could be sitting there doing nothing for 30 minutes and you've moved the pedals around 3 times. Or you could be there at like 150 RPM on like resistance 10 or whatever and absolutely sweating your ass off. And that's probably going to equate to more than the steps would have. So it's very hard to say. I'm going to more on the side of caution and say, like, if you're looking to make up like 6,000 steps, an hour on the bike would be a better idea. Again, depends on, like, you'll know this yourself, right? If you're playing on your phone the whole time, which I sometimes do doing cardio, like, it doesn't need to be balls to the walls. But if that's how you're going to do it and you're going to be like, oh yeah, well, I'm going to use this time to reply to some emails or like text my mates or whatever, totally fine. But realize that your energy expenditure will be lower, so you'll need to stay on the bike for longer.
Yeah. Perfect. Cool. What is counted as a portion of fruit or veg?
I think I already answered this one in a check-in.
So,
but I'll go over it again.
Yeah, go for it.
So this individual was like a little bit confused, or maybe not confused, but just exactly what is a portion of fruit and veg, and what we kind of care a little bit less about that and more about the variety. Like, obviously be sensible. Like, if you have one pea, that does not count as a portion of fruit and veg. But if there's, you know, we want a big variety. So when we put in the accountability check-ins, how many fruit and veg have you had today? It's about the different fruit and veg you've had. You can't just say, I had 5 fruit and veg, it was 5 apples. No, we want variety there. So that's what we're looking for on that.
Perfect. Right. Technique question. When doing a chest press, I never feel it in my pecs. It always seems to fatigue or target my shoulders and arms. I try to lower the bar dumbbells to the middle of my chest. Is that right? Should my elbows go lower than the bench? Not sure if I am just not going heavy enough or my techniques are wrong. Any tips?
That's nice and simple.
Question. Yeah, nice and simple. So, if you generally, this is casting a massive aspersion again, but most people that I deal with bench or push up wrong to start off with, and it's because the angle between the inside of their arm and the rib cage is too wide. So they, if you were to get a, is it a protractor that you used to use at school? It tells you the degrees, I think.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. If you, I think it is, but if you were to look at a body straight up in a benching position, most people will bench with a 90 degree bend. So
Pythagoras' theorem. Yes, okay, yeah, I got you now.
So they'll have a 90 degree angle for the side of their body to the underside of their arm by via their armpit, where in actual fact you want to be closer to 45 degrees in angle. The reason being is that if you've got your elbows are too high, your shoulders and your arms will do most of the work. Well, your shoulders will do most of your work when you're too wide. If you're too narrow, so if your elbows are scraping your sides, your triceps will do the majority of the work. If you take a middle point in between, which is if you were to look dead ahead, is about 45 degrees, you'll find that more pec activation happens. As for things like dropping the elbows below the bench, I would suggest that that depends on how flexible you are and if you can keep the pec engaged. But as a general rule of thumb, I would always remember to try and keep the dumbbells up, sort of, as you're coming past the chest, the dumbbells, middle of the dumbbells shouldn't go past, your thumb level should not go past your chest. If you drop in too much, what normally happens is your shoulder rotates forward and you end up having to use your shoulder to push the dumbbell back rather than using your pec or the barbell, whatever it is you're using. I've done a couple of videos on this, so I'll put this up in the Facebook group, or just a couple of wee technique ones with that, and how to work out your angles on your benching and your push-ups and stuff as well.
Perfect.
Also, a question regarding cortisol. I have PCOS, and this may be cortisol-related. Am I right in thinking there's a link between higher cortisol levels and weight gain? Is the reason just because you overeat when stressed, so it links back to calories in versus calories out, or is there more science behind this?
Yes, that is. So when you're looking at hormones and how they impact your weight, your hormones, if they are making you gain or lose weight, will be doing so by affecting your energy balance. So that either means that they are making you expend less energy or eat more energy, consume more energy. That is how they affect. There's no other way that they can impact your weight. Nothing gets past energy balance. So when we're looking at PCOS and maybe increased cortisol levels or increased cortisol levels for any reason, yes, the link there is either you are eating more or you're moving less, or for some reason your basal metabolic rate has dropped, which means, again, you are expending less energy. I had this discussion with someone on Instagram the other day about how your basal metabolic rate could drop unless you'd be in a deficit and not losing weight. And the point is, you're not then in a deficit because your energy expenditure has dropped. There's no way around it. And that is how hormones affect weight loss as well. Interesting thing, I'd actually just put a post up about this, but interesting effect of the gut microbiome on PCOS. So if you are listening, which you should be because you are on the Commit Six, then make sure you are getting in your fruit and veg, because that is going to have potentially a really big benefit for you, making sure that your gut microbiome is nice and diverse. And the best way to do that is really just to have a varied diet, maybe get in some kefir, however the hell you say it. And do you like, what's sauerkraut? Is that how you say it?
No.
That's how you say it. Me.
Yeah, no, sauerkraut, not for me. Kefir, or however you want to say it, not for me.
I force myself to drink kefir, whatever it's called. I force myself to drink that just because I think they're onto something with that. I think that's a good one. And then sometimes I'll put like sauerkraut in my stir fry so that I can't taste it. Tastes like hell.
Kombucha is quite good for that as well, but like I've tried that and it tastes like shit in a can as far as I'm concerned.
I've not tried it, which is very unfitness of me.
Well, there's loads of people are making their own stuff now as well.
Which freaks me out. My dad's tried to make his own kefir, whatever.
All you do is you just leave milk out in front in the sun on the windowsill until it's fuzzy and foamy. You're fine. It's great. It's penicillin. It's what Marie Curie sorted the world with. So, yeah, drink away. Cool. Next one. Do you have any tips for sticking within your calories as much as possible when eating out socially? I will often save calories for a meal out so that I know I'm within my calorie budget. And if I want to eat lower calories, I'll go for leaner options such as chicken, fish, diet drinks, etc. I'd be interested to know what you guys do when dieting. Any other tips to recommend? Some pretty good tips you've just given there yourself, to be fair. Keeping calories back throughout the day, potentially, you know, maybe doing like an intermittent fast where you don't eat until lunchtime. So you've got your breakfast calories also added into your dinner. Things like look preempting the menu, have a look at the menu, see what's there. You know, let's remember a restaurant is generally pretty good at if you're like, look, I'd like a burger, but I don't want the bun. If you can just
like
give me
three
some
quarters extra of the bun cut off.
Yeah, or just leave it. You know, there's no point. There's no reason why you can't leave stuff on the plate. We've discussed this many times that, you know, because of your upbringing, you're told that you need to leave an empty plate. You're not allowed to leave the table to have an empty plate. When in actual fact, it's probably the worst thing to tell anybody because they feel they have to finish stuff. Yeah.
Portions are going to be bigger. Always are. So even if you just think, like, leave a bit. There's a couple of things, like, you've mentioned brilliant things that, like, we would have gone over, but, like, those are great tips. But things like add about 10% to whatever you think the meal is going to be or whatever it says on the menu, maybe add 10% just to be sure that you are in a deficit. That's especially true. Like, if you're eating out once a week, it doesn't really matter. If you're eating out, like, most nights this week, definitely think about adding like 10 to potentially 20% depending on like where you are and what the meal is. I would also say that the like fasting can work, like, or just skipping breakfast, whatever you want to call it. But sometimes that leaves you a little bit too hungry and then you overeat at the restaurant, where actually if you had had breakfast and then you'd left half the chips that you ordered, that might have actually been better. And then the portion thing, like, they probably will be bigger portions. The one thing I struggle with a little bit when eating out, not so much, like, if I'm dieting, I do a little bit, and I spoke to a couple of clients in check-ins about this week actually, is food volume. So you often don't get half the food volume that you're maybe used to getting now that you're making your meals at home and you're quite conscious of, okay, I want this meal to fill me up. So I'm going to have a big side salad. I'm having a portion of veg as well. And I'm having like a jacket potato because I know that potato gives me a big like food volume bang for my buck. But then I go out to a restaurant and I'm having pasta. There's no side, there's no veg. Like, and it just doesn't fill me up because it's quite a small serving for the given calories. That can be a bit of an issue. I don't have a great piece of advice there, but like that's just something to think about.
It's a good thing to be mindful of, though. It's not something that you can really, that's something that you can't really solve, that's kind of out of your control. So
yeah, because even if you're like, oh, could I have, like, I mean, you could always ask for like, oh, could I have extra salad instead of chips or whatever, and they might give you extra salad. And make sure you don't get dressing covered all over it. But even when you order like sides of veg in restaurants, they come covered in butter anyway. So you're probably not, or they come with like cooked in something usually, even if you ask for them not to be. I don't know. You can find ways around it a bit, but then I always resent paying like £3 or £4 for like a side of like a tiny amount of peas or something. And I'm like, that must have cost you like 5p.
You can tell you go out in Dundee, because in Edinburgh that's about 12 quid for that side, so that's a side portion of peas.
It's been that long since I've been out for dinner.
But no, I think as well, you know, when you stuff like that, if you're being eaten out socially, you also have to remember as well that it's a choice. You don't, this is going to sound really bad, but I had another conversation with one of my one-to-one check-ins as well about the fact that you're going to have to start. If you are wanting to really make a change and see some differences, you're going to have to maybe give up that one of the two nights out you've got that weekend. So you either go out Friday or Saturday, you're not going out both, because you're not going to be able to stick within your calories having two nights. So being a little bit harder on yourself, and also being a bit more stubborn, where you're like, right, I'm gonna have to choose which one I'm doing.
Yeah, or that's exactly it, isn't it? It's not about sacrifice, it's about choosing your indulgences.
Yeah, it's a choice, and at the end of the day, it's a choice. You know, you've made a decision to cut away some body fat, but at the same point, that decision has ramifications on not being able to go out four nights a week, you know, or going out to Friday, Saturday and Sunday afternoon and going and having a shed load of alcohol. You know, if you've just made that decision, you're going to have to, you're going to have to play hardball with yourself as well.
And that's results, not a bad thing. Or excuses, you can't have both.
Exactly.
Yeah, right, this will have to be the last question, because
my weight has went down, but measurements are all the same. How can this be?
Well, the reason behind that is measurements are notoriously hard to do accurately. And the amount you're going to see change in 2 weeks, or if it's a one-to-one client, a week, it's negligible. It's going to be really, really hard to see. So the fact that your weight has gone down is brilliant. That means we're on the right track. Your measurements will come down eventually. Sometimes it works the other way. Sometimes you've not lost weight, but your measurements have come down. So just go with it. Something says that it's going in the right direction. Don't stress too much. I will say, measurements are really, really hard to do. And it could be something as simple as you measured it slightly higher up your thigh or your waist or whatever, like a slightly different point.
Even for us, measurements are difficult, because you would have to go to the lengths of measuring if you're doing your arm. And yeah, neither do I. Because you would have to measure from the elbow to the top of the shoulder, take a point in the middle, and you'd have to be on that exact mark every single time to make it even. And it'd be the same with your waist. You'd have to go to your belly button, down an inch, and you need to get that inch every time.
Did you do your ISAC training with the calipers?
Did you use the Harpenden, the ones that have the wooden box? It looks like something that
These have been calibrated by a monk. It was so
a monk at the top of Everest.
It was 3 days of probably the most boring 3 days of my life.
It's genuinely mind-numbingly boring, because it's and now you can buy a set of Harpenden calipers. They're only £3,000. Fucking what now? £3,000.
I was like, oh, I've got my own calipers.
I've got my own calipers. But then you go like that. I got a plastic pair on Amazon for four quid. They're great. So the measurements.
No, I think the pinch test is fine. I mean, it's not. Clients don't normally like it if you're just like, mind if I just grab your fat just to see what's the difference between last week? But if you're doing it with yourself, you can sort of be like, feels like less.
You're better to ask them first as well. Don't just randomly jump on and do it.
This is why I was forced to move into online coaching. Too many concerns. I'm not like training with Emma. It's just really weird. She just kept grabbing me . Okay, so, well, that was a lovely podcast. Thank you.
Perfect.